Hi, everybody. My name is Mike. I'm a recovering sexaholic. I've been sober since June 3rd, 1984. My home group is St. Teresa's Wednesday night in Chicago, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm actually kind of touched to be here. I was telling Bill just a moment ago that the city of Nashville has been very, very good to me over the years. They've invited me back here three or four times. So, you know, I'm not saying they're healthy. I'm just saying they've been good to me. And so my first words are words of thanks to Nashville for asking me to speak and for being good to me, taking good care of me for many, many years. My second words of thanks are to my own group, St. Teresa's Wednesday night group. They were really excited that I was going to speak. Six of them came down and three of them have already flown back. It's not about me, I keep being reminded. So, well, one more thing before I get into the kind of the meat of this thing. I want to say that, well, you know what, I'm going to do it a different way. Let me do it this way. Let me read you the first tradition, if I might. I'm doing this for two reasons. One, I think it's a good idea, and two, that way I'll remember what it is and I'm supposed to talk about it. Tradition one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on SA unity. So that's what I was asked to speak about. My own belief is it's really hard to speak about tradition one unless you also speak about tradition five. So I'm going to read that if I might. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the sexaholic who still suffers. In other words, why do we need this unity? Why does our common welfare come first? Why does personal recovery depend on SA unity? Because we have a message we got to carry to the sexaholic who still suffers. I want to just briefly say something about two men, maybe three, we'll see. I want to mention Jess L. from Bozeman, Montana, who's been dead now, I don't know how long, a long time. He was as... How many people personally met or knew Jess? Interesting. Only about 30%, maybe even less, of the crowd. How many have heard Jess on a tape or a CD? Okay, about two-thirds. This is just my view, okay? I'm not saying this was Jess. This is how I perceive Jess. Extroverted, way out there, sometimes saying things he would later... Jess usually had to make three or four amends per conference for what he said publicly. He got all the Catholic priests really mad one time as he said something when he was trying to collect, you know, raise the ante on what we put in the basket, and he said, especially you priests, because you're the biggest perverts of all, or something like that. One of the priests in our group, boy, he... By the time he was done with them, Jess, I think he made about five amends on that one. He just was right out there. And he called me one day when he was dying. And he said to me, Mike, I don't know how to die. And he burst into tears on the phone. And I didn't have the slightest idea what to say to this lovely poor man. So I said to him, well, you seem to be doing a pretty good job of it, Jess. Because you're talking about it. You're doing what we do in Sexaholics Anonymous. He was carrying a message to me, the suffering. He was a suffering sexaholic looking for help, but by admitting that to me, he carried a message to me about how to die. Now another man, completely different in personality. He'd have his sort of manic burst, but mostly a quiet guy. I would say, from my perspective, again, an introvert, Jim Egan. A quiet man, a sweet man, a man who many of you, how many people know about or are involved with the daily recommitment to sobriety? I don't know if Jim wrote it, but I know I think he may have wrote it. He at least got it out there. Jim was much more introverted, and yet in his own quiet way had great, great influence on me, and I think on many of us here in Sexaholics Anonymous. Principles before personalities, absolutely. But sometimes our principles get communicated to us, not as is often thought, despite our personalities, but through our personalities. God works through us. I'd say nice things about Harvey, but he's still alive, and I think that's... I think we'll save that for another time, except if... That's right, I agree. I told him the other night, I told him, I haven't asked many favors of him, I only asked one, don't die. I love Harvey too. I love Harvey too much to say I'll be a basket case, but Harvey's been a godsend to me from day one. Now I'd like to read Tradition 1 and Tradition 5 a second time, but I'm going to read you the long form. Please, please listen to the difference. Tradition 1, the long form. Each member of Sexaholics Anonymous is but a small part of a great whole. SA must continue to live or most of us will surely die. Hence our common welfare comes first, but individual welfare follows close afterward. I wonder why Bill and these guys, when they wrote this, put, but individual welfare follows close afterwards. My belief is that they did it because when they first heard this, if that wouldn't have been in there, everybody would have said, what about me? Bunch of sexaholics, or in this case, at that time, alcoholics saying, what do you mean? Hey, Bill, I'm sorry. You are but a small part of a great whole. What? No, I'm not. I'm Bill S. Just using Bill as an example. No reflection on Bill. Okay. Each one of us is but a small part of a great whole. SA must continue to live, or most of us will surely die. And you know, we're all going to die anyway, whether SA lives or not. But we'll die drunk. Clearly that's the implication here. Hence our common welfare comes first. But individual welfare follows close afterward. In other words, the we is more important than the me. Tradition 5, long form. Each Sexaholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the sexaholic who still suffers. Interesting to me why they even need a long form. I mean, the difference between the short and the long form is almost nothing. Short form, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the sexaholic who still suffers. Long form, each Sexaholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the sex. What's the difference? The difference is spiritual entity. I don't know why they took it out, you know, why have a short and a long form for three words, but apparently maybe they wanted to bury that. So I'd like to bring it back to life if I might. Each group ought to be a spiritual entity. We always say the steps are for the individuals and the traditions are for the group, and obviously most of us are much more well-versed in the steps than we are in the traditions. And that's fine if you're new. It's not so fine if you've been around for a while. St. Teresa's group, Wednesday night, not a perfect group. I've been going around the world giving a talk called Building a Culture of Sobriety. They've loved it everywhere except in Chicago. Where I was told that, you know, I thought my group was the greatest and we were arrogant. And so let me just say, what I'm going to share with you, you know, as an individual, what am I taught in this program? What can I share with you that counts? My experience, strength, and hope. And once I get beyond that, I'm into opinions and I'm into a lot of stuff and I'm off base. That's what I've been taught. So if I'm going to talk to you about the traditions and if I'm going to talk to you about a group being a spiritual entity, I can only share the experience, strength, and group, the hope of my group. That's all I got. So I'm not sharing you this because you have to do it exactly this way. I'm telling you, here's some things we've learned as we have consciously tried, or at least that I have consciously tried in working with our group, to say, this isn't just about my recovery or your recovery. This is about this group becoming a spiritual entity so that anybody who walks in knows what our primary purpose is. So, I'm going to give you what's going to sound like a laundry list. And I'm going to ask you to do me a favor. Don't take notes. Buy the CD. Not because I want you to hear me, but I want you to listen. Some of these are going to be obvious. They're going to be things you do. Some of them are going to be new. Some of them you might like. Some of them you might not like. But just take it easy and we'll run through these. Some things we do in no particular order. We continue to do a short share at our meeting. Some groups have abandoned that, where everybody simply checks in around the room once. This is the nature of my sexual addiction and how long I've been sexually sober. Now, there's problems with the short share because a lot of guys like to go into whether they're in other 12-step programs, and then we have to tell them we don't care. They'd like to go into their life history and every character defect they ever had. We don't want all that, guys. But what we want is, this is what I did out there. This is what qualifies me, and here's how long I've been sober. Number two, the format of our meeting, one of two things. We read a step out of the white book, and we comment on the step because we want to focus on working the 12 steps. Or, if someone has an anniversary of 4 years or more, they give a lead. That's our format. Number three, we ask people to dress appropriately. The only specifics that we mention are no shorts, no tank tops, and now get ready for the most controversial thing you'll hear all weekend. Please wear socks. Now, how the heck did we come up with socks? A guy came up to me and he said, I got a foot fetish, and summertime is driving me crazy in this meeting. Now, I'm not saying this is the only way to handle this. One way to handle it is to say, well, you're going to have to learn to live with it, pal. But what we decided was, I don't want to be too graphic here, although Harvey would tell me it's okay, but if someone had a fetish for some other body parts, we would be covering those body parts. So we simply developed a group conscience around asking people to wear socks. Oh my God, the resistance. Oh my God. Occasionally appropriate and direct, like in a business meeting, but usually just the same guy forgetting 4 weeks in a row. You know? A spiritual entity with one primary purpose. A safe place, another way of thinking about that. We still, when we go around the room for sharing after the reading or the lead, ask those members who have 30 days or more sobriety to share first. We haven't gotten to the point where we don't let the other people share or where the people with more time get more time to share, but we have continued to stress sobriety first. Okay, my pet peeve in our meeting. It's getting better. At the end of the meeting, the chair usually asks somebody to read a vision for you and then someone to lead the Lord's Prayer. And there's usually a sense, sort of a spiritual sense going on, like usually they pick somebody maybe who said something important in the meeting or, you know, you can... But until we worked harder at tradition 1 and 5, the person most likely to be asked to lead the Lord's Prayer or to read a vision for you were the two guys who relapsed that week. Why? Because the chairperson felt compassion for them. And I began to say in our business meetings and to members, especially my own sponsees who have at least less choice about whether or not they have to listen to me, I began to say, no, ask the guy who just had his anniversary. Ask anybody except the guy who relapsed. Don't pay attention to him. Don't say, oh, You relapsed for the fourth time this year, Bill. It's okay. Would you lead us in the Lord's Prayer? Congratulations, you just violated our primary purpose by acting out again. Please lead us in the Lord's Prayer. Controversial? I don't know, but it's working for us. Sobriety requirements for leadership posts. We don't have a problem with that in our group, but our inner group continues to have controversy about why do we have to have sobriety requirements, especially relatively strict ones. Why do people have to be sober to be on the inner group? I like to make comparisons to Alcoholics Anonymous. Would you have three or four guys who just came out of the bar, drunk as a skunk, sitting around a meeting discussing the future of Alcoholics Anonymous in your region? Group conscience. Here's the way our group conscience works. And the reason is we want to be a spiritual entity, a unified spiritual entity, sticking to our primary purpose. We have a business meeting once a month. You want to change anything about our meeting, you bring it to the business meeting once a month. It gets discussed at that business meeting. Usually, very rarely is a vote taken at that business meeting. It's usually discussed at least one more month. Then, if there's a proposal that gets passed, it's brought to the large group to the beginning of our regular meeting, and it's voted up or down with no discussion allowed. In other words, if you want to be part of the group conscience of our meeting, you have to come to the business meeting. You can't just show up with 3 days of sobriety and bring something up in the middle of our meeting and hold it hostage for 30 minutes while everybody's chomping at the bit to get to what they came there for, which is to stay sober and help the suffering sexaholic to achieve sobriety. The reason that we never vote the first business meeting is to see what the mood of the group is, and this may be controversial, to make sure if we hear some stuff that we don't think is right, that we get all the old timers together and stack the vote for the second business meeting. Some people think, oh, that's too political. So? Spiritual entity. Now, not Chicago politics. I'm grateful. I'm grateful that growing up in a certain community has given me certain gifts, don't get me wrong. But it really is to say that if we're going to do something different in this meeting, it's going to have to jump through enough hoops to make sure that it is about our primary purpose. A few more. Still raise our hands if we think people are getting too explicit. Harvey and I have a little debate about that going. I told him that the real reason we're having the debate, I told him today, is because he's Jewish and I'm Irish. I'll tell you a story. I once had my kids at the zoo, and I don't remember what kind of animals they were, but these two animals started having sex. And my wife and I'm saying to her, should we cover the kids' eyes? And then I'm saying to her, well, you figure it out. I'm triggered. I gotta go. Meanwhile, there's this Jewish family standing next to us, and the mother says to the husband, Harry, get the kids. I want them to see the animals copulating. True story. So I think when Harvey says, you know, maybe we should allow more explicitness, and I say I'm not so sure, I think we all come from where we come from. But anyway. We have found in our group, and I don't know how many groups still do this, that this whole thing about putting a lot of energy into a newcomer, writing out his first step, and delivering it to the whole group in this great moment of catharsis doesn't work. So we don't do it. The guys still write it out, some of them, depending on who their sponsor is, and they might sit and read it to three or four guys. But we found that the greater the written first step, the greater the reaction to the written first step in the large group, the more likely that guy was to relapse. Why? I'm not sure, but my guess was because we had put the individual above the group. It's your night, Bill. You're the newcomer. You're the star. I saw a guy get a standing ovation after he delivered his first step. 3 months later, he was drunk as a skunk. We just didn't see it fitting in with a spiritual entity with a primary purpose. We didn't see it fitting in with personal recovery or individual follows closely after group. Now, this has to do with sponsorship. We've been doing for 5 or 6 years now, maybe longer, what we call check meetings. Let's say Dimitri's sponsoring John, and I'm sponsoring Dimitri. And Dimitri keeps calling me saying, I'm having troubles with John, he's doing this and that. It could be that John's relapsing, which for the record he's not. It could be that John is, you know, just in a power struggle with Dimitri over, you know, some suggestion Dimitri's making. Who knows what it is? At some point, I might say to Dimitri, do you need a check meeting? I ask the sponsor, not the sponsee, do you need a check meeting? And if he says yes, I say, why don't we get 4 or 5 guys and after the regular meeting Wednesday night, we're going to sit and talk. Where we'll be more explicit. And we'll get 4 or 5 guys, sober, solid guys or gals. In our group, it's mostly guys, so I'm not being sexist. It's just the way it is. We have one regular woman who I'll talk about in a minute. But anyway, we sit around and we say to Dimitri, what's going on? The sponsor speaks first. Then we say to John, do you have anything to add? Then we simply go around the room and people make comments to these two guys that they wouldn't be able to do, nor would it be appropriate to do in a regular meeting format. This has been, for us, the most powerful tool to help Tradition 1 and Tradition 5 come to life in our meetings. Because as a group, we're taking care of each other. The days where I sponsor Dimitri and nobody in the world knows what's going on between me and Dimitri, but me and Dimitri, they're over in Chicago. Because it's a recipe for disaster. It sets me up to be an expert, which I'm not. It sets me up to live in a vacuum with this man's disease, which could make my disease alive again. And let me say something about confidentiality or anonymity. That is controversial for some people. I am going to protect every one of your anonymity. There's no way in hell that anything you've said in this meeting or who you are is going to get spread. But if Bill comes to me today and he says to me, Mike, I'm going to tell you something, and you have to promise not to tell anyone, not even anyone in SA, I'm going to say, Bill, I do not want to hear it unless I have your permission to take it to another member should I find it troublesome. I will not hear it. If there is no confidentiality. Does that mean that my sponsees, that I'm going to share every secret they told me with everybody in the group? No. But if I need to share something to help that person stay sober, and more importantly, as Tradition 1 says, more importantly, to help my group be a sober group, I'm going to do it. And if you're not going to let me do it, don't tell me. I do not want to know. The days where everybody's working their little... Here's this group of people. We have 62 people last Wednesday night. And we're going to have 31 sponsor-sponsee relationships and nobody knows anything about them. And we wonder why the group can't get more sober? I would like to suggest that for Sexaholics Anonymous, if I have one suggestion to make here today, is those days should be over. We, as a group, become a spiritual entity we love each other enough to get involved in one another's lives and help each other stay sober. And then, about every 2 to 3 years, we do a group inventory. We take 3 or 4 weeks where we have no regular meeting. Oh no, but I got to check in. Call your sponsor. We're doing a group inventory to make sure that we are becoming more and more a spiritual entity able to carry the message to the sexaholic who still suffers. Because each member, it tells us here in Tradition 1, is but a small part of the great whole. The purpose of this, my opinion, the purpose of this, and it took me a long time to understand this because it took a long time for me to come to life enough to be a good enough lover. What a great lead Robin gave Saturday at lunch. What a fantastic Essanon lead. What I saw was this woman had become a lover. And I realized that that could trigger some people because we're sexaholics. When I say that, what everybody's thinking of is exactly the opposite of what I'm talking about. She's a true lover. She knows how to love because she's been sober long enough. And what she said and what I'm trying to say is, I've become enough of a lover to figure out today the purpose of the group isn't to keep me sober. It's not for me. The purpose of the group is for me to become a lover so I can help you stay sober, so we can help each other stay sober, because that's what we were created to do, is to love each other. And in our case, because of our illness, the way we love each other is we help the suffering sexaholic. That's what we do. And a lot of times in my life, I don't know what my purpose is. I'm 51 years old and sometimes I don't know why I'm on this planet in the larger world of my life. I struggle with it. But when I come into these rooms, it's absolutely clear to me. And I don't know if I'm becoming a bleeding deacon. I honestly don't think so, but you're going to have to tell me. But I'm going to tell you this. If I have anything to say about it, our groups are going to start focusing on becoming a spiritual entity so that if Dimitri calls me and says, John is having trouble and I'm having trouble, because how lonely a job it is to be a sponsor if you have to do it by yourself. And why do we understand that nobody walks alone, that we'll help you do anything to stay sober? Why do we understand that for the sponsee and not for the sponsor? I went to my group 5 years ago and said, look, I'm sponsoring 10 people. I can't do anymore. Some of you guys got to start sponsoring. Could we get a list around and get moving here? I need help. So that's some things we're doing in our group. Why? I've already alluded to it. Because we need it. We need it. We can't afford to have lousy groups. We need every group to get a few people together to begin to build what I call a critical mass of sobriety that then slowly over time becomes a spiritual entity. I'd like to spend my last few minutes telling you why it's so important to me from a different point of view, from a personal point of view. As some of you know, my mother died on July 3rd, 2006. My brother Terry, a happily sober member of this program and a member of our group, his wife has cancer. She had chemo again on Thursday. She's very, very depressed. The tumor is neither shrinking or growing at this point. And nobody knows what is happening. My other brother, who I barely talked to, his wife had a heart attack. And I bit the bullet and went over to his house and visited, not knowing if, you know, I figured I'd probably be let in, but I didn't know how it would go. And it actually went pretty well. Jim Egan died this fall. I miss him. And Kathy, my wife, her mother died on April 26, 2008. At 93, or 92, she did pretty well for herself. My son is 20 years old. I met Louise today from Dublin. I don't know if she's in here or not, but my son's spending his junior year of college at Trinity in Dublin. He told me two stories when he came home on Christmas break. The first was that a friend of his, a female, in fact, the girl he took to senior prom, although they're not dating or anything, they were in a pub, and some guy was so drunk he started not only hitting on this young woman, but physically sort of, I don't know if assaulting is too strong or not, but you know, doing stuff he wasn't supposed to do. And my son said that he walked over, picked the guy up, and just moved him. I said, "Oh my God, what did he do?" He said, "Oh, he was so drunk, I don't even think he noticed." Told me another story. He told me that a guy who had barely ever drank a whole bottle of vodka one night. He said, "I was afraid he might die, Dad. Those are the kind of stories you hear about people dying." So I stayed with him all night, and he said, sure enough, at about 2 in the morning, he walked in the middle of the street, and a car was coming at him 50 miles an hour, and he said he had no idea, Dad, that car was coming. And I ran out in the middle of the street and pushed him across the street, and he said, "I'm not trying to brag or anything, Dad. I'm just telling you, I saved his life." And he said, "Then I got him in a cab, and he puked all over the cab, and the cab driver was furious, and I said to the cab driver, 'I'll pay you to clean it up.' And the guy said, 'Give me 50 bucks or 50 euro or whatever it is." And he gave him the money, and he got this guy to bed. And he's telling me the story, and I'm thinking, oh, he's a codependent. No, no. In the morning, he woke the guy up, and he said, "I know you're hungover and everything, but you owe me 50 bucks. My point is, I spent some time in Ireland after college. I spent a summer in Cork. When I was there, I would have been the guy he was pulling off the girl. And I'd have been the guy he was pushing out of the way. Something has changed. And it is not my virtue. A group existed for me. Jerry S. is here. I don't know if he's still here. And Jerry started our group in 1987. And there was a group for me. When I needed to leave some other S programs because I was staying sober despite rather than because of the meetings, there was a group that had begun to become a spiritual entity waiting for me that had a message of recovery, a real message. I'm going to close with this. It's going to take about 5 minutes. I might be a little over, but I know we started a little late, so I'm going to ask Bill's permission. This is something I wrote in Edmonton. I know Farley's here somewhere, so a couple of you have heard this. I'm reading it because I want you to understand. We talk about what we need is the example of a life that's making it, right? For that to happen, it is my belief that we need the example of groups that are making it. And if the group is making it, it's a lot more likely that the individual is going to make it. And that, in my mind, at least for today, is the heart of traditions 1 and 5, unity and spiritual entity and primary purpose. So, I read you a true story. A man sits in the dining room reading the paper. All about the house, his family roams, his wife, his daughter, his two sister-in-laws, and his mother-in-law. He feels a touch on his right shoulder. He turns to the right. He raises his eyes to see who has interrupted his reading of the sports section. His mother-in-law, known as Cece, briefly smiles and turns away, walking into the kitchen. The man who hates interrupting eruptions, rejoices at this moment. He knows without any doubt, quite rare for him a doubter, what this little interchange means. She loves him. He rejoices. Another story also true. This same man, 25 years earlier, stands in the same house, this time in the bathroom. He is trimming his beard, his first beard, preparing to take Cece's daughter out for a night on the town after spending the evening on the rollaway in the living room. As is apparently often the case, unbeknownst to him, he does not clean up the sink after trimming his beard. Later, he hears about this gently from Cece's daughter. Cece apparently had noticed, but her husband, Dave, had intervened to explain to Cece that, like alcoholism, leaving your beard trimmings in the sink was no more than a good man's fault. So Cece says nothing to the man. He is not, as he feared, reprimanded. This mother-in-law, Cece, insisted on visiting and writing the man's mother when she lay dying of Alzheimer's. She asked invariably about the man's siblings, nephews, nieces, cousins, and co-workers, often amazing the man because she knew more about them than he did. This last St. Patrick's Day, at the annual party at this man and his wife's house, the friends and relatives were all gathered. Amidst the usual eating, drinking, music, non-alcoholic drinking, by the way, just for the record, and wealth of entertainment provided by the guests themselves, a new ritual emerged. Throughout the night, almost unnoticed, one by one, you had to be looking. The various siblings, nephews, nieces, cousins, not only of the man's wife, but of the man himself, all quietly stopped by the chair of Cece to visit. Most of them either chatted her up or, as is often the case, vice versa. The man's son, however, simply sat down next to his half-awake grandmother and began to play the violin, mistakenly thinking his great act of love and respect had gone unnoticed. This man's mother-in-law, Cece, did not feel about baseball the way the man did, although she did grow to love the game, if only to be part of her grandchildren's lives. But Cece did worry about the man. She would marvel incredulously at how he could sit around the house all day, quietly, without barely a word to say, and suddenly the Cub game would come on. He would pace in and out of her kitchen, in and out of her living room, screaming, sometimes almost cursing, and since this is a rigorously honest program, sometimes actually cursing. It would be the worst when he would do this in the back room with the windows open, meaning that the greatest of Irish sins had been committed. The neighbors had heard. She never complained about this sudden, irrational change in the man. She would only say to him, or sometimes to his wife, "I worry about you with those cubs." And then, to relieve his angst, the worse his behavior, the more likely the result, a sandwich and a Sprite brought to him as if he were a king. She grew to root more and more for those cubs over the years, as I say, mostly on account of her grandchildren. But the man knew, too, that she wanted him not to worry, so that he could eat his sandwich in peace. How many of you remember a television show from the 1960s called Combat? Anybody? Wow, a fair number of people. Combat was a World War II drama. two of the main stars were Vic Morrow was Sergeant Saunders, and a guy named Pierre something was a character named Cage. He was one of the soldiers. Just giving you that, otherwise this next piece makes no sense. When last summer, the man and his daughter pretended to be Sergeant Saunders and Cage, crawling along a beach in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, and suddenly threw a rubber ball masquerading as a grenade onto the grass near Cece and the man's wife. The ball accidentally bounced up and hit Cece right on the arm. She just laughed and played dead. The man and his daughter smiled at one another. Another dead German done in by Sergeant Saunders. When the man taught a course on the history of Catholic Chicago in the suburb of Wilmette, he looked up amazed one night to see his mother-in-law sitting in the class. At the age of 88, she'd gotten on the subway and come all the way up to the suburbs to see what she could learn about her history. The man had a secret favorite thing to do. Didn't happen often enough, but he'd get there, Cece's house, on a Friday afternoon, before anybody else had arrived, when work was over for the week, and he could let his anxieties go, and he would listen to Cece tell stories. Stories about her uncle who'd been in the Irish Republican Army and who had had to leave the country, and they wondered where he had gone. And one day they were sitting on their porch on Drake Avenue in the city of Chicago, and they said, "That man walking down the street, he looks like my uncle from Ireland." Cece's sister lived two doors down. As he walked up that doorstep and rang the bell, they realized it was his uncle from Ireland, and they all ran over to say hello. Cece told that story at least 10 times a year. Or the one about her father when they'd say, "Dad, would you ever go back to Ireland?" And he would say, "I never had a bite to eat, and I never had a shoe on my foot. And if it was at the alley gate, I would not go back." The man would listen to these stories forever. That's how it is with Cece. Before you know it, you're immersed in story. And this leads me to this rare experience of grief. Cece died April 26, 2008. I had no crisis to resolve with her. I had no business to finish. I had no what-ifs. Sure, I might have told her I cherished her more often, but I knew it made her uncomfortable, so I simply sent her a card every year on Mother's Day that said, "To the greatest mother-in-law that ever was." And that's the part of this rare experience. It is so dreadful and so sad and so disheartening to have lost her. And yet, so rich and beautiful, because the depth of this loss that I feel, that has left me so bereft and heartbroken and lonesome, is a testimony to the depth of our love for one another. And this is the point. They say that people hold back on love to avoid deep pain. Maybe that's why we're all sitting here. And I get it, I really do. But I say, give me the love, and I will give you the love. And let us learn to take the pain. Next St. Patrick's Day, Cece will not be with us. I will not hear the story about the Irish Republican Army uncle or the alley gate. I won't watch her outwork everyone in the kitchen between stories. My hope is someone else will tell the stories and that she and they will not be forgotten. But it won't be the same without her unassuming presence that yet somehow still filled the room. If there is not a heaven, I believe that God would create one just for Cece and fill it with her friends who've left us all behind. In the meantime, I can still feel that light touch upon my shoulder, like the touch of God herself telling me that she loved me. A life that's making it because of a group that's making it. Thank you.